Side 7, The Tommyknockers by Stephen King. Continuing on page 186. At age 3, Hilly one day climbed out of his crib where he was supposed to be taking a nap.
"Why do I have to have a nap, Mom?" Hilly asked.
"Because I need the rest, Hilly," his exhausted mother replied. Wriggled out the window and knocked over all 12 of the planters, stumps and all. When Marie saw what Hilly had done, she wept as inconsolably as she had wept over her boy's poor thumbs. Seeing her cry, Hilly had also burst into tears around his thumbs. He was attempting to suck both of them at once. He hadn't knocked over the stumps and the planters to be mean. It had just seemed a good idea at the time. "You don't count the cost, Hilly," his father said on that occasion. He would say it a good many times before Sunday, July 17, 1988. At the age of 5, Hilly got on his sled and shot down the ice-coated brown driveway one December day and out into the road. It never occurred to him, he told his ashy-faced mother later, to wonder if something might be coming down Derry Road. He had gotten up, seen the glaze of ice that had fallen, and had only wondered how fast his flexible flyer would go down their driveway. Marie saw him, saw the fuel tanker lumbering down Route 9, and shrieked Hilly's name so loudly that she could barely talk above a whisper for the next 2 days. That night, trembling in Bryant's arms, she told him she had seen the boy's tombstone in Homeland, had actually seen it, Hillman Richard Brown, 1978-1983, taken too soon. Hilly's head snapped around at the sound of his mother's scream, which sounded to him as loud as a jet plane. As a result, he fell off his sled just before it reached the foot of the driveway. The driveway was asphalted, the glaze of sleet was really quite thin, and Hilly Brown never had that knack with which a kind God blesses most squirmy, active children, the knack of falling lucky. He broke his left arm just above the elbow and fetched his forehead such a dreadful crack that he knocked himself out. His flexible flyer shot into the road. The driver of the Weber fuel truck reacted before he had a chance to see there was no one on the sled. He spun the wheel, and the tanker truck waltzed into a low embankment of snow with the huge grace of the elephant ballet dancers in Fantasia. It crashed through and landed in the ditch, canted alarmingly to one side. Less than 5 minutes after the driver wriggled out of the passenger door and ran to Marie Brown, the truck tipped over on its side and lay in the frozen grass like a dead mastodon, expensive number 2 fuel oil gurgling out of its 3 overflow vents. Marie was running down the road with her unconscious child in her arms, screaming. In her terror and confusion, she felt sure that Hilly must have been run over, even though she had quite clearly seen him fall off his sled at the bottom of the driveway. "Is he dead?" the tanker driver screamed. His eyes were wide, his face pale as paper, his hair standing on end. There was a dark spot spreading on the crotch of his pants. "Oh, suffering Jesus, lady, is he dead?"
"I think so," Marie wept. "I think he is. Oh, I think he's dead."
"Who's dead?" Hilly asked, opening his eyes.
"Oh, Hilly, thank God,"
Marie screamed and hugged him. Hilly screamed back with great enthusiasm. She was grinding together the splintered ends of the broken bone in his left arm. Hilly spent the next 3 days in Derry Home Hospital.
"It'll slow him down, at least," Bryant Brown said the next evening over a dinner of baked beans and hot dogs.
Ev Hillman happened to be taking dinner with them that evening. Since his wife had died, Ev Hillman did that every now and again, about 5 evenings out of every 7 on the average.
"Want to bet?"
Ev said now, cackling through a mouthful of cornbread. Bryant cocked a sour eye at his father-in-law and said nothing. As usual, Ev was right. That was one of the reasons Bryant so often felt sour about him. On his second night in the hospital, long after the other children in pediatrics were asleep, Hilly decided to go exploring. How he got past the duty nurse was a mystery, but get past he did. He was discovered missing at 3 in the morning. An initial search of the pediatrics ward did not turn him up. Neither did a floor-wide search. Security was called in. A search of the whole hospital was then mounted. Administrators who had at first only been mildly annoyed were now becoming worried and discovered nothing. Hilly's father and mother were called and came in at once looking shell-shocked. Marie was weeping, but because of her swollen larynx, she could only do so in a breathy croak.
"We think he may have wandered out of the building somehow,"
the head of administrative services told them.
"How the hell could a 5-year-old just wander out of the building?"
Bryant shouted.
"What kind of a place you guys running here?"
Well, you understand it's hardly a prison, Mr. Brown." Marie cut them both off.
"You've got to find him," she whispered. "It's only 22 degrees out there. Hilly was in his PJs. He could be...
"Oh, Mrs. Brown, I really think such worries are premature,"
the head of administrative services broke in, smiling sincerely. He did not, in fact, think they were premature at all. The first thing he had done after ascertaining that the boy might have been gone ever since the 11 o'clock bed check was to find out how cold the night had been. The answer had occasioned a call to Dr. Elfman, who specialized in cases of hypothermia. There were a lot of those in Maine winters. Dr. Elfman's prognosis was grave.
"If he got out, he's probably dead,"
Elfman said. Another hospital-wide search, this one augmented by Derry police and firemen, turned up nothing. Marie Brown was given a sedative and put to bed. The only good news was of a negative sort. So far, no one had found Hilly's frozen, pajama-clad body. Of course, the head of administrative services thought, the Penobscot River was close to the hospital. Its surface had frozen. It was just possible that the boy had tried to cross the ice and had plunged through. Oh, how he wished the Browns had taken their little brat to Eastern Maine Medical. At 2 that afternoon, Bryant Brown sat numbly in a chair beside his sleeping wife, wondering how he could tell her their only child was dead, if it became necessary to do so. At about that same time, a janitor who was in the basement to check on the laundry boilers saw an amazing sight. A small boy wearing nothing but pajama bottoms and a plaster cast on one arm, strolling nonchalantly between two of the hospital's giant furnaces in his bare feet. "Hey!" the janitor yelled. "Hey, kid!"
"Hi!"
Hilly said, coming over. His feet were black with dirt. His pajama bottoms were swatched with grease.
"Boy, this is a big place. I think I'm lost."
The janitor carried Hilly upstairs to the administration office. The head sat Hilly down in a large wing chair, after prudently putting down a double spread of the Bangor Daily News, and sent his secretary out to fetch back a Pepsi-Cola and a bag of Reese's Pieces for the brat. Under other circumstances, the head would have gone himself, thereby impressing the boy with his grandfatherly kindness. Under other circumstances, by which I mean, the head thought grimly to himself, with a different boy. He was afraid to leave Hilly alone. When the secretary came back with the candy and the soft drink, the head sent her away again, after Bryant Brown this time. Bryant was a strong man, but when he saw Hilly sitting in the head's wing chair, his dirty feet swinging 4 inches off the rug, and the papers crackling under his butt as he ate candy and drank Pepsi, he was unable to hold back his tears of relief and thanksgiving. This, of course, made Hilly, who never in his life had ever done anything consciously bad, also burst into tears.
"Christ, Hilly, where you been?"
Hilly told the story as best he could, leaving Bryant and the head to parse objective truth out of it as best they could. "He had gotten lost, wandered into the basement. I was following a pixie," Hilly told them, "and had crawled under one of the furnaces to sleep. It had been very warm there," he told them, "so warm he had taken off his pajama shirt, working it carefully over the new cast."
"I like the pups, too," he said. "Can we have a puppy, Daddy?"
The janitor who had spotted Hilly also found Hilly's shirt. It was under the number 2 furnace. Getting the shirt out, he saw the puppies, too, although they skittered away from his light. He did not mention them to Mr. and Mrs. Brown, who looked like folks who would just fall apart if faced with one more shock. The janitor, a kindly man, thought they would do just as well not knowing that their son had spent the night with a pack of basement rats, some of which had indeed looked as large as puppies as they fled from his flashlight beam. 2. Asked for his perceptions of these things, and the similar, if less spectacular, incidents that occurred over the next 5 years of his life, Hilly would have shrugged and said, I'm always getting in trouble, I guess. Hilly meant he was accident-prone, but no one had taught him this valuable phrase yet. When he was 8, 2 years after David was born, he brought home a note from Mrs. Underhill, his third-grade teacher, asking if Mr. and Mrs. Brown could come in for a brief conference. The Browns went, not without some trepidation. They knew that during the previous week, Haven's third-graders had been given IQ tests. Bryant was secretly convinced that Mrs. Underhill was going to tell them Hilly had tested far below normal and would have to be put in remedial classes. Marie was convinced, and just as secretly, that Hilly was dyslexic. Neither had slept very well the night before. What Mrs. Underhill told them was that Hilly was completely off the scale. Bluntly put, the lad was a genius. "You'll have to take him to Bangor and have him take the Wechsler test if you want to know how high his IQ actually is," Mrs. Underhill told him. "Giving Hilly the Tom Paul IQ test is like trying to determine a human's IQ by giving him an intelligence test designed for goats." Marie and Bryant discussed it and decided against pursuing the matter any further. They didn't really want to know how bright Hilly was. It was enough to know he was not disadvantaged. And, as Marie said that night in bed, it explained so much. Hilly's restlessness, his apparent inability to sleep much more than 6 hours a night, his fierce interests which blew in like hurricanes, then blew out again with the same rapidity. One day, when Hilly was almost 9, she had come back from the post office with baby David to find the kitchen, which had been spotless when she left only 15 minutes before, a complete shambles. The sink was full of flour-clotted bowls. There was a puddle of melting butter on the counter. And something was cooking in the oven. Marie popped David quickly in his playpen and had pulled the oven open, expecting to be greeted by billows of smoke and the smell of burning. Instead, she found a tray of Bisquick rolls, which, while misshapen, were quite tasty. They had had them for supper that night. But before then, Marie had paddled Hilly's bottom and sent him wailing apologies to his room. Then she had sat down at the kitchen table and cried until she laughed, while David, a placid, happy-go-lucky baby who was a sunny Tahiti to Hilly's Cape of Storms, sat holding the bars of the playpen, staring at her comically. One mark very much in Hilly's favor was his frank love for his brother. And although Marie and Bryant hesitated to let Hilly hold the new baby, or even to leave Hilly alone in the same room with David for more than, say, 30 seconds at a time, they gradually relaxed. "Hell, you could send Hilly and David off for 2 weeks camping up in the Allagash together, and they'd come back fine," Ev Hillman said. "He loves that kid, and he's good with it." This proved to be so. Most, if not quite all, of Hilly's in troubles stemmed from either an honest desire to help his parents or to better himself. They simply went wrong, that was all. But with David, who worshipped the ground on which his older brother walked, Hilly always seemed to go right. Until the 17th of July, that was, when Hilly did the trick. 3. Mr. Robertson Davies, may his death be postponed 1,000 years, has suggested in his Deptford trilogy that our attitude toward magic and magicians in large part indicates our attitude toward reality, and that our attitudes on the matter of reality indicate our attitudes toward the whole world of wonders in which we find ourselves. Nothing but babes in the woods, even the oldest of us, even Mr. Davies himself, one must believe, where some of the trees bite and some confer great mystic favors, a property in their bark, no doubt. Hilly Brown very much felt he did exist in a world of wonders. This had always been his attitude, and it never changed, no matter how many in troubles he had. The world was as mystically beautiful as the glass balls his mother and father hung on the Christmas tree each year. Hilly longed to hang some, too, but experience had taught him, as it had his parents, that to hand a glass ball to Hilly was to issue that glass ball's death warrant. To Hilly, the world was as gorgeously perplexing as the Rubik's Cube he had gotten for his 9th birthday.
The cube was gorgeously perplexing for 2 weeks, anyway, and then Hilly began to solve it routinely. His attitude toward magic was thus predictable. He loved it. Magic was made for Hilly Brown. Unfortunately, Hilly Brown, like Dunstable Ramsay in Davies' Deptford trilogy, was not made for magic. On the occasion of Hilly's 10th birthday, Bryant Brown had to stop at the Dairy Mall to pick up another present for his son. Marie had called him on his coffee break. "My dad forgot to get Hilly anything, Bryant. He wanted to know if he'd stop at the mall and buy him a toy or something. He'll pay you when his check comes in."
"Sure,"
Bryant said, thinking, "and pigs will ride broomsticks." "Thanks, honey," she said gratefully. She knew perfectly well that her father, who now took dinner with them 6 and 7 nights a week instead of just 5, was the sandpaper on her husband's soul. But he had never complained, and for this Marie loved him dearly.
"What did he think Hilly might like?"
"He said he'd trust your judgment," she said.
"Typical," Bryant thought.
So he had found himself in one of the mall's 2 toy stores that afternoon, looking at games, dolls, the dolls for boys going under the euphemism action figures, models, and kits. Bryant saw a large chemistry set, thought of Hilly mixing things up in test tubes, and shuddered. Nothing seemed quite right. At 10, his eldest son had reached an age when he was too old for baby toys and too young for such sophisticated items as box kites or gas-powered model planes. Nothing seemed quite right, and he was pressed for time. Hilly's birthday party was scheduled for 5, and it was 4:15 now. That barely left him time to get home. He grabbed the magic set almost at random. 30 new tricks, the box said.
Good.
Hours of fun for the young prestidigitator, the box said.
Also good.
Ages 8 to 12, the box said. Fine. Safety tested for the young conjurer, the box said, and that was best of all. Bryant bought it and smuggled it into the house under his jacket while Ev Hillman was leading Hilly, David, and 3 of Hilly's friends in a rousing off-key chorus of Sweet Betsy from Pike.
You're just in time for birthday cake, Marie said, kissing him.
Wrap this first, will you?
He handed her the magic kit. She gave it a quick glance and nodded.
How's it going?
Fine, she said. When it was Hilly's turn to pin the tail on the donkey, he tripped on a table leg and stuck the pin into Stanley Jernigan's arm, but that's all so far. Bryant cheered up at once. Things really were going well. The year before, while wriggling into Hilly's neatest all-time hiding place during a game of hide-and-go-seek, Eddie Golden had torn his leg open on a strand of rusty barbed wire Hilly had always managed to miss. Hilly had, in fact, never even seen that old piece of sticker wire at all. Eddie had to go to the doctor, who treated him to 3 stitches and a tetanus shot. Poor Eddie had had a bad reaction to the shot and had spent the 2 days following Hilly's 9th birthday in the hospital. Now Marie smiled and kissed Bryant again.
Dad thanks you, she said.
And so do I. Hilly opened all his presents with pleasure, but when he opened the magic set, he was transported with joy. He rushed to his grandfather, who had by that time managed to wolf down half of Hilly's devil's food birthday cake and was even then cutting himself another slice, and hugged him fiercely.
Thanks, Grampy. Thanks. Just what I wanted. How did you know?
Ev Hillman smiled warmly at his grandson.
I guess I ain't forgot everything about being a boy, he said.
It's boss, Grampy. Wow, 30 tricks. Look, Barney.
Whirling to show Barney Applegate, he whacked the corner of the box into Marie's coffee cup, breaking it. Coffee sprayed and scalded Barney's arm. Barney screamed.
Sorry, Barney, Hilly said, still dancing. His eyes were so bright they seemed almost afire. But look! Neato, huh? Awesome!
With the 3 or 4 gifts for which Bryant and Marie had saved and then ordered far in advance from an FAO Schwartz catalog to make sure they would arrive on time, thus relegated to the status of spear carriers in a jungle epic, Bryant and Marie exchanged a telepathic glance.
Gee, honey, I'm sorry, her eyes said.
Well, what the hell, that's life with Hilly, his replied.
They both burst out laughing. The partygoers turned to look at them for a moment.
Marie never forgot David's round, solemn eyes, and then turned back to watch Hilly open his magic set.
"I wonder if there's any of that maple walnut ice cream left,"
Ev wondered aloud. And Hilly, who that afternoon believed his grandfather to be the greatest man on earth, ran to get it. 4.
Mr. Robertson Davies has also suggested in his Deptford trilogy that the same great truism which applies to writing, painting, picking horses at the track, and telling lies in a sincerely believable way also applies to magic. Some people got the knack and some people don't. Hilly didn't. In Davies' Fifth Business, the first of the Deptford books, the narrator, enchanted by magic, he is a boy of about Hilly's age, does any number of tricks, badly, for an approving, uncritical audience of one, a much younger boy of about David's age, with this ironic result. The older boy discovers the younger has the great natural talent for prestidigitation he himself lacks. This younger boy puts the narrator completely to shame, in fact, the first time he ever tries to palm a shilling. On this last point, the similarity broke down. David had no more talent for magic than Hilly did. But David adored his brother, and would have sat in patient, attentive, loving silence if, instead of trying to make the jacks run from the burning house, or Victor the family cat pop out of his magician's hat, said hat was thrown out in June when Victor shat in it, he had lectured to David on the thermodynamics of steam, or read him all the begats from the Gospel according to Matthew. Not that Hilly was an utter failure as a magician, he wasn't. In fact, Hilly Brown's first gala magic show, which was held on the Brown's back lawn on the day Jim Gardiner left Troy to join the New England Poetry Caravan, was considered a great success. A dozen children, mostly Hilly's friends, but with a few of David's from nursery school thrown in for good measure, and 4 or 5 adults showed up and watched Hilly do almost a dozen tricks, give or take. Most of these tricks worked, not because of any talent or real flair, but because of the sheer determination with which Hilly had rehearsed. All the intelligence and determination in the world cannot create art without a bit of talent. But intelligence and determination can create some great forgeries. Besides, there was this to be said for the magic set Bryant had picked up almost at random, its creators, knowing that most of the aspiring magicians into whose hands their creation would fall were apt to be clumsy and untalented, had relied mostly upon mechanical devices. You had to work to screw up the multiplying coins, for instance. The same went for the magic guillotine, a tiny model with Made in Taiwan stamped discreetly on its plastic base, loaded with a razor blade. When a nervous member of the audience, or a perfectly blasé David, put his finger into the guillotine's cradle above a hole which held a cigarette, Hilly would slam the blade down, cut the cigarette in two, but leave the finger miraculously whole. Not all of the tricks depended on mechanical devices for their effect. Hilly spent hours practicing a two-handed shuffle, which allowed him to float a card on the bottom of a deck to the top. He actually got quite good at it, not knowing that a good float is much more useful to a card weasel like Pitts Barfield than to a magician. In an audience of more than 20, the atmosphere of living room intimacy is lost, and even the most spectacular card tricks usually fall flat. Hilly's audience was small enough, however, so he was able to charm them, adults as well as children, by nonchalantly peeling cards that had been stuck into the middle of the deck from the top, by causing Rosalie Skehan to find a card which she had looked at and then pushed back into the deck, residing in her purse, and, of course, by making the jacks run from the burning house, which may be the best card trick ever invented. There were failures, of course. Hilly without screw-ups, Bryant said that night in bed would be like McDonald's without hamburgers. When he attempted to pour a pitcher of water into a handkerchief he had borrowed from Joe Paulson, the postman who would be electrocuted about a month later, he succeeded in doing no more than wetting both the handkerchief and the front of his pants. Victor refused to pop out of the hat. Most embarrassing, the disappearing coins, a trick Hilly had sweat blood to master, went wrong. He palmed the coins, actually cartwheel-sized rounds of chocolate wrapped in gold foil and marketed under the trade name Munchy Money, with no trouble.
But, as he was turning around, they all fell out of his sleeve, to the general hilarity and wild applause of his friends. Still, the round of applause at the end of Hilly's show was genuine. Everyone agreed that Hilly Brown was quite a magician, for only 10. Only 3 people disagreed with this judgment. Marie Brown, Bryant Brown, and Hilly himself. "He still hasn't found it, has he?" Marie asked her husband that night in bed. Both of them understood that it was whatever God had for Hilly to do with the searchlight he had put in Hilly's brain.
"No,"
Bryant said after a long thinking pause.
"I don't think so. But he worked hard, didn't he? Worked like a cart horse."
"Yes," she said. "I was glad to see him do it. It's good to know he can, instead of just jumping from pillar to post. But it made me a little sad, too. He worked at those tricks the way a college kid studies for his finals."
"I know."
Marie sighed. "He's had his show. I suppose now he'll drop it and go on to something else. He'll find it eventually." 5. At first it seemed that Marie was right, that Hilly's interest in magic would go the way of Hilly's interest in ant farms, moon rocks, and ventriloquism. The magic set had moved from under his bed, where it was handy in case Hilly woke up in the middle of the night with an idea, to the top of his cluttered desk. Marie recognized this as the opening scene in an old play. The denouement would come when the magic set was finally relegated to the dusty recesses of the attic. But Hilly's mind hadn't moved on. It was nothing as simple as that. The 2 weeks following his magic show were periods of fairly deep depression for Hilly. This was something his parents didn't sense and never knew. David knew, but at 4 there was nothing he could do about it, other than to hope Hilly would cheer up. Hilly Brown was trying to cope with the idea that for the first time in his life, he had failed at something he really wanted to do. He had been pleased with the applause and congratulations, and he was not so self-deprecating as to mistake honest praise for politeness. But there was a stony part of him, the part which under other circumstances might have made him a great artist, which was not satisfied with honest praise. Honest praise, this stony part insisted, was what the bunglers of the world heaped on the heads of the barely competent. In short, honest praise was not enough. Hilly did not think all this in such adult terms, of course, but he did think it. If his mother had known his thoughts, she would have been very angry with him for his pride, which, her Bible taught her, went before a fall. Certainly she would have been angrier with him than she'd been the time he slid into the road in front of the Weber oil truck, or the time he tried to give Victor a bubble bath in the toilet bowl. "What do you want, Hilly?" she would have cried, throwing up her hands. "Dishonest praise?" Ev, who saw much, and David, who saw more, could have told her. "He wanted to make their eyes get so big they looked like they were going to fall out. He wanted to make the girls scream and the boys yell. He wanted to make everyone laugh when Victor came out of that hat with a ribbon in his tail and a chocolate coin in his mouth. He would have traded all the honest praise and genuine applause in the world for just one scream, one belly laugh, one woman fainting dead away like the booklet says they did when Harry Houdini did his famous milk can escape. Because honest praise means you only got good. When they scream and laugh and faint, that means you got great." But he suspected, no, he knew, that he was never going to get great, and all the want in the world would not change that fact. It was a bitter blow. Not the failure itself, so much as the knowing it couldn't be changed. It was like the end of Santa Claus, in a way. So, while his parents believed his lapse of interest to be just another shift in the capricious spring wind that blows through most childhoods, it was, in fact, the result of Hilly's first adult conclusion. If he was never going to get great at magic, he ought to put the set away. He couldn't leave it around and just do a trick now and then as a hobby. His failure hurt too badly for that. It was a bad equation. Best erase it and try a new one. If adults could put aside their obsessions with such firmness, the world would undoubtedly be a better place. Robertson Davies does not say that in his Deptford trilogy, but he strongly hints at it.